There are some books and passages in the Bible that we tend to shy away from because they are hard to understand or they're kind of intense. And I think James, there are some passages in James that we'd rather just dance over. And because we didn't have a lot of time, it would have been quite easy for me to do that. But in 2 Timothy chapter 3, 16 and 17, it says, All scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, that the man or woman of God may be complete, equipped for every good work. And so I decided I wouldn't skip over the hard passages. I thought we'd dive right in this morning to some of the more challenging texts in James, because as it says in Timothy, all scripture is inspired by God and is there for our correction and sometimes for our reproof, and we need that, right? And so we are going to take the wisdom from all of it and glean the wisdom that we can gain in all of it. And so we're going to walk into the world of words. James has quite a few things to say about words. A couple of questions that I thought of when I was thinking about words is, how many words are spoken, do you think, every single day? Imagine that. Like, if we could capture all the words that were thrown out into the air and then all the words that were captured on paper, there would be an enormous amount of words daily, right? I did a little Wikipedia, which is what you look up online, and it says that if Wikipedia were a book, it would be more than 2 billion pages. You know, we just look up there to make references. Sometimes it's factual, sometimes it's not. But if we captured all of those words, we would have 2 billion pages. That's not just even the words themselves. I don't know if you're familiar with Twitter, or any of you on Twitter. It's this little place that you can send out notes, and they're usually quite small. And it's done in the form of media. And all around the world, people do what's called tweeting. And so you tweet this little message. It's like a little bird song, tweet, tweet. That's probably why they call it a tweet. And I was walking around this morning, and the birds were already singing. There are more than 1 billion tweets sent every 48 hours. Right? Each minute, there are 150,000 messages sent on Facebook. That's per minute. 150,000 messages are sent on Facebook. That's per minute. Did I say that? Because that boggles my mind. There are 3 million blogs. Blogs are these kind of pages where you can read what other people have to say. Many of you know that. Some of you may not. 3 million blogs come online every month. Wow. Right. And this is all information from the International Association of Chief of Police Media Center for Social Media. Because they need to keep kind of a watch out on what's been said around the world. It's an enormous amount of words that are going out every day that we read, that we take in, that we hear. And then according to the National Center for Voice and Speech, the average rate for English speakers in the US is about 150 words per minute. Right? That's hard to get my head around, honestly. So, and in Science magazine, 16,000 words a day are spoken by both men and women is the average. So ladies, don't let people tell you that women speak more than men. Because in the Science magazine, it says that 16,000 words a day. And do you know that they did a record of who spoke the least words? I don't know how they did this, but they did some sort of test. Again, this was in the Science magazine. And they were both men who spoke the least and the most words in a day. So a man spoke 500 words, which is far below the average. And then there was another man who spoke 49,000 words in a day. So, I mean, I could go on and on, right? And there's this illustration of what it means to live in the world of words. And so I think it's important that we would attend to what James says to us about the world of words, because we live in a world full of words. And so In chapter 1, verse 19, he says, "Beloved, be quick to hear and slow to speak." In chapter 1, verse 26, he says, "If anyone thinks they're religious and do not bridle their tongue but deceive their heart, this person's spiritual life is worthless." And then he kicks it into fifth gear in chapter 3. So we'll read that together. Chapter 3 is where we'll be this morning. Let's begin together. We'll read verses 1 and 2. "Not many of you should become teachers, oh no, my brothers and sisters, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. For we all stumble in many ways. And if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle his whole body." So James starts out this notion of what it means to use our words, and he starts out with a warning to teachers. Teachers, you have got to be responsible and careful in the things that you say, because the more you know, the greater the responsibility and therefore the greater accountability. So he starts out with those who work in the world of words and issues a word of caution. Be careful. But then he goes on and says, we all stumble. So first of all, there's this group of folks who are teachers, but then just casts the net out to all of us. So we're all included, to all. The rest of the passage then makes no references to teachers. So we're all included after that. And he says something that we all should consider, that anyone who doesn't stumble with their words is perfect. How many people in here would raise their hands and say they never stumble with their words? No. Because there's not one of us in here that's perfect. Nor are we asked to be. So we're off the hook. Right? We don't exist. And then he goes on to tell us about the tongue. Chapter 3, verses 3 to 5. "If we put bits into the mouths of horses so that they obey us, we guide their whole bodies as well. Look at the ships also. Though they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are guided by a very small rudder. Wherever the will of the pilot directs, so also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great things." Here we're being told that the tongue is small and yet it is powerful. And he gives these two analogies, similar to last night. We get this analogy of being on the waves. Now today he gives us these two analogies to give us clear indication of what the tongue is like. The horse, the bit that is inside the horse, its ability to keep the horse going in a particular kind of direction. It's just a very small thing that goes inside the mouth or in the kind of clasped around. Yesterday I went for a walk down this hill and I saw these horses down there, and so I decided to go over there and I put my hand on the side of the horse, and it's this big, it's a big animal, right? And it's quite remarkable to think that something so small has the capacity to maneuver it one direction or the other. I've only ridden a horse once, and I felt quite afraid, honestly. Like, you're vulnerable. You're sitting on top of this animal that could just take you off anywhere or throw you off. And what James is saying here is there's something so small that has the capacity to direct it. And the same with the ship. These large ships that are out at sea, what is it that keeps it going in the right direction? The rudder, the tiny little rudder at the back. The ship's pilot retains power over the ship because they have control of the rudder. Not because they have even the sails in some ways, it's the rudder that keeps the ship going in the right direction. And using those illustrations or analogies, James wants to draw our attention to the power of the tongue. Though it is the smallest part of the body, or one of the smallest parts of the body, it has a great deal of power, which is what he wants us to see. It's a small member and it boasts of great things. And boasting, though, is actually neutral. Because you can boast, what you boast about determines whether it's good or bad, right? This morning as we were singing that song, we're praising God higher and higher. We are boasting in the goodness of God. So it's a neutral statement, what we boast in. We can boast in that which is good, or we can boast in other things. But the tongue legitimately claims this substantial power for good or for harm. There was one day in Salt Lake City where I live, I joined this bike situation where you have, there's these bikes that you just have in the city, and you get your card and you just plug it in and then you can take a bike. And so the first year that I lived there, I lived in an apartment downtown. And I decided that I would just take my bike to work because there was a little bike. I don't know what you'd call that. Where do you park a bike? In a bar? What is it? A bike rack. Right. That seems obvious. So it's this bike rack, but you pay and then you get your bike out of the bike rack. So I got on my green bike and I'm riding right downtown. And, you know, I'm being mindful of my bike and I have my helmet on, and it suddenly made me more aware of traffic and more aware of all the things that were going on. And I also realized that there are a lot of people that are tourists that are on these green bikes and they don't actually know where they're going, and they're a bit wobbly and they're all over the place, and so you're kind of maneuvering all around them. Well, there's one day where I was running a bit late for work, so I wasn't able to get on my bike. So I got in the car and I was driving down to work, and there they were, the bike person, the bike tourist. And they're all wobbly, and we're going down, it's Main Street, so there's Main Street runs east to west, and State Street runs north to south, and they're both really busy streets. So I'm at that intersection, and there's said green bike person, all wobbly. And so I'm in my car, I'm trying to be mindful of the green bike person, and I'm driving slowly, and I'm getting some speed to go through, and then all of a sudden this pedestrian steps out in front of me. And I'm like, oh no, I'm trying to avoid the dude on the bike, and now you're standing out in front of me, and I break, and you know, my heart's all aflutter. I'm like, oh, I'm going to hit this guy, I didn't hit him. It's a nice sunny day, so the windows are down, and then there's this burly guy on a motorbike, long hair, all, you know, burly, big dude on his Harley, and he just like shouts at me, "Nice save!" So yes, that's right. So instead of like grumbling about the fact that we've got a tourist person on their green bike and I don't know what pedestrian's doing here, this guy uses his tongue and totally turns my day around. Right. My God, nice save! Yeah. So then I'm driving to work and I'm like, oh, so good. I'm so epic on my car right now. So instead of being, he used his tongue. This neutral thing had the capacity. He could have said all sorts of things. What an idiot. People need to watch where they're going. Why so many tourists? But instead, he said something encouraging. Nice save. So what we do with our tongue can determine the outcome. Our tongue boasts of great things, whether for good or for destruction. But James does make it clear that the power of the tongue for destruction is quite remarkable, quite large. Verses 5 and 6. We read that. So the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great things, that neutral statement. And we go on, how great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of life, and set on fire by hell. There is this picture here that when the tongue is out of control, it has a great capacity for harm. And he gives us two more pictures. This forest fire, just this little spark in a dry environment, can set the whole forest ablaze. I live in a dry climate and it's dry here, and there's that sense where there's caution. There are signs that ask us to be cautious because of the implications of what can happen if there were to be a spark from a fire that went out and caused havoc. It would destroy some of the land, beautiful land, because of irresponsibility with a fire. And so it also is with the tongue. There's a sense that we can reap a great deal of harm through irresponsibility in the use of the tongue. And what's seen are the effects of a forest fire. I don't know if any of you have seen those effects. And this analogy, it's analogous of what's left when we're not responsible with our tongue. It's destructive. And the magnitude of it is emphasized here. It's the entire course of life. It says it right there in verse 6. Setting on fire the entire course of life. There's a magnitude here, this whole person, past, present, and future. The things that we hear and the things that we say can have implications because of the enormous power. And they are kindled. Again, we talked last night about the places in which this destructive power comes, and says that it's kindled from hell. This destructive power is kindled from hell, and it's in the text a literal place of hell here. The word is Gehenna, which some of you may be familiar with. And Gehenna was a place outside of Jerusalem, outside of the walls. That's where they took the trash. It's where people who were unclean had to go. It was a place where at night there is no safety. So the wilderness that is outside the city walls can wreak havoc because of wild animals or criminals. It's a place of danger, a place of unrest, a place of insecurity, a place of darkness, a place that can bring abuse and hate. And that's where this picture is, that that's where the destructive power of the tongue can come when it's not used responsibly. And the next picture is that it's untamable. This, so many things can be tamed. Let's look at that together. For every kind of beast and bird, verse 7, of reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil. Not only does it have the capacity to reap an enormous amount of destruction, it's untamable. It's this part of us that is untamable. And the picture here is this poisonous reality that can come out. You know, when you're walking along, I have to say, when I was walking yesterday, I was a little terrified that I was going to run into a rattlesnake. Right? Out of nowhere, there's this venomous attack that can just get me. And that's this picture, a snake, this untamable, and though a snake actually can be tamed, but the tongue is like this venomous, poisonous snake that can come and attack at any moment. It can strike. And I think when we hear James's words, it sounds severe, this destructive power like a fire or untamable reality like a snake. But more often than not, we underestimate the power of the tongue. You know the old adage? You do know it. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words or names will never hurt me. James would be up in here being like, no. Why do we even say that? There was a woman I met once, and we were both teaching at a seminary, and I had been asked to come in as kind of a guest speaker at this seminary, and she was there speaking too. We were talking about women's roles in the church, and when I met her, she's in her 50s, I was in my early 30s, and I didn't know her prior. Didn't know what her position was or where she was in terms of understanding. And when I met her, the thing that struck me most about her was her kindness. She was so kind. And we both taught, and we both were working together with this other gentleman who was actually leading the class, and we just kind of supplemented his seminary class. And afterwards because of what she said. She was so articulate, she was brilliant, and she was kind. And sometimes in these kinds of conversations, there's not a lot of kindness. And so I decided I would like to talk more to you for a number of reasons. So after the class, I waited around and wanted to talk to her, and so I asked her if I could have her phone number or if I could get her email. And so subsequently, a couple of days later, I emailed her and I said, I'd love to be able to have coffee with you or lunch. And she said, absolutely, let's go and have lunch. So I met up with her, we went to lunch, and we sat down at the table together and we both ordered separate things. And I just wanted to know her story. I wanted to know who she was, where she'd come from, what her life had been like, because she was such a fascinating woman. And she sat down at the table and she ordered her food, and I said to her, you know, I nearly ordered that because it looked so good too, but I ended up ordering this other thing. And she just leaned in and she said, will you just help yourself off my plate? She said, I have 7 children. She's like, so usually people just take off my plate. And I was like, whoa, 7 children. I was like, I'm already getting to know interesting things about you. So I asked her, you know, I just wanted, she said, you know, what did you want to chat about? And I just said to her, well, I'd like to know you. I'd like to know who you are. And so she told me who she was. She told me she'd studied, she had a doctorate, she had these 7 children, she was also a nurse. I was like, whew, you've been at it. And one thing she said to me, she said, you know, but I have to tell you that I learned to take a punch from my mother. I was all, what? She said, yeah, when I was a child, my mother was really abusive. And she said, there was one time where my mother hurt me so badly that she had to take me to the hospital. And we were going to the hospital, and in those days, she said, in Oregon, you weren't allowed to be seen by anybody unless you paid this fee on the way in. And she said, I'd had to convince my mother to take me to the hospital in the first place. And she made me vow that I wouldn't tell anyone that she was the one that had hurt me so badly, that she was the one needing to take me in. And she's like, I made that promise. And she's like, and I kept it. And she said, so we walked into the hospital, and she said that sign was there that, you know, this fee that you have to pay in order to be able to see somebody. And she said her mother looked at the sign, and I think it was something like $30. And she said her mother looked at the sign and she looked back at her and she said, you're not worth $30. And then she looked at me while we're sitting there over our meal and she said, I've had to do more work over that statement than the fact that she put me there because of her physical harm. And she said, you know, Heather, she probably would never have been, she probably wouldn't have had to face the consequences for saying something like that to me. But she would have. She said, I didn't tell them that it was her. But she said she probably would have gone to jail. But then she reiterated. She said she never would have gone to jail for that statement. She said that statement was more powerful to me than what she did to me physically. And then she said something really profound. She said, there are 3 types of pain in this world, Heather. The pain of staying the same, the pain of getting worse, and the pain of getting better. She's like, it's all painful. Pick your pain. And I was all, I know which one you picked. She's like, yeah, I've worked hard. And I was like, yeah, you have. And you're kind, and you're generous, and you've worked hard. Maybe you've had someone say something like that to you. Maybe you've said something painful to somebody else. James says these types of things destroy us. They destroy others. And they have their origins in the world of the destroyer. And with our language, we belittle and we brag and we flatter. We self-deprecate. We exaggerate. We lie. We use language to make other people feel sorry for us. And we use language to make much of ourselves. And we do these things even when we wish we didn't or we wouldn't. And I know I gave you kind of a severe example with my professor friend, but I think there are moments where we can all resonate that we walk away from a conversation and we're like, ah, shouldn't have said that. Wish I hadn't said that. Whether it's to a spouse or a friend or a coworker or a daughter or a son. And it's this small part of our body that just feels untamable. And by being untamable, it has the capacity to be destructive. And it doesn't stop there, unfortunately. He speaks about those of us who say that we believe in God. Let's look together. Verse 9. With our tongues we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. To bless is to speak good, kind of like the burly guy on the bike. And to curse is to do the opposite. A curse in the Old Testament was basically that you wanted somebody to experience absence from God eternally. Basically, you wanted to damn them. That's a curse. Basically, I want nothing good for you day after day after day. And I don't know that we do that overtly, but we sometimes do it covertly. We wish people's ill upon them by our thoughts and through our words. And one minute we can be here and we can be singing and we can be praising, and the next minute we turn around and we do the complete opposite. We say things to people that are not honoring of the God that we praised just seconds before. And when we do that, we come before God and bless him. We despise those who are made in his very image, because we're all made in the image of God in the Imago Dei. It's like saying to a mother that you love her and in the same breath saying that you hate her daughter. It's just incongruent, right? It doesn't work like that. When we do these things, we kind of display our discrepancy, the duplicity again that we talked about last night, and we live divided, praising one minute, disdaining the next. James says to us, sisters, let's not do that. He says brothers, but. And I think in this moment it can feel a bit hopeless, because he said it's untamable. Like, there's this part of us that is out of control, and we recognize the destruction that our tongues can have in the lives that we live. And so his final picture is a bit of a picture of hope. The tongue is small, but it ultimately reveals the heart, is what he says in this last picture. Verse 11. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and salt water? Can a fig tree, my brothers, bear olives, or a grapevine produce figs? Neither can a salt pond yield fresh water. Let's read that again. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and salt water? Can a fig tree, my brothers, bear olives, or a grapevine produce figs? Neither can a salt pond yield fresh water. When you read that, you're like, James must have been talking to Jesus. Because he kind of comes up with this parable. A lot of the time Jesus spoke in parables, right? And you think to yourself, what is he going on about? He's talking about the tongue, and then all of a sudden we get this picture about this fruit tree and this spring. And I think what is being said here is there's a picture that the tongue is revealing the heart. The tongue produces according to the nature of the heart. And this illustration comes, what happens when a tree that is an olive tree bears fruit? What fruit does it produce? Olives, right? And if you're a fig tree, what fruit comes out? Figs. So he's saying there's something that is produced by its nature. Its very nature produces its fruit. Same with the fresh water, the spring where its roots are fresh, what comes out of it? Fresh. When it's salty, you take a sip, salty. And so Jesus makes a similar analogy in Matthew. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 12. He's having multiple conversations with the religious leaders of the day. And they have been constantly contradicting themselves. Their words and their actions don't match up. They are not honoring their parents. They're acting like hypocrites. And they have issues with healing on the Sabbath. And so Jesus is talking to his disciples after he said these things to them, which has offended them. And then because Jesus has called out these religious leaders, and then in chapter 12 and verse 33, he says this. Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad. This is the point actually where he's talking to the Pharisees. For the tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers. Again, this poison. How can you speak good when you are evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So out of the nature, out of the abundance of the heart, so the mouth speaks. He's calling them out so that there is something not wrong necessarily with their mouth, but there is something wrong with their heart. He clarifies this later to his disciples in chapter 15. Again, he's talking about the religious people who lead these duplicitous lives. They're praising God with their mouths, and yet they're cursing the people around them. And he says, specifically talking to Peter, the Pharisees are offended by the words of Jesus. And Jesus reiterates this as he talks to Peter in chapter 15 and verse 18. He says, if I can find it, but what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this defiles a person. Both James and Jesus want us to see that it's who we are, not so much what we do or what we say, that is important for us to land on, to sit with, to stay with. Jesus is clear in these two specific cases that our words are an outflow of our heart. Basically, when we're pressed, like what is expressed or is expelled out of us comes out of a deeper place, out of the inner place. It's pressed out of our hearts and speaks through our lips. So in order to change the way we talk, what needs to change? Our heart. We can't sustain just telling ourselves and willing ourselves that we're going to do this. James would say that's an exercise in futility because the tongue is untamable. Words are an overflow more than willpower. It's the internal place of the heart that needs healing, that needs changing, that needs transforming. And that's the place from which our speech will come. The Augustine says, let God be sought that man may be tamed. How do you tame the tongue? You change the heart. Change our nature. Change our sense of being. So how do you change? You bring your heart to Christ. Let him change you. He renews the heart. He transforms the heart. He cleanses the heart. He speaks life into the heart. He forgives the heart. And the heart is the place of our deepest being, not just the seat of our emotions. We must be continually changed at our deepest level. And in being changed, we can be sure then that our words, that which is pressed out of us, will be indicative of our nature. So it's who we are that needs transforming. And then we can bring words of life and of beauty and of goodness and of wholeness to those around us. Jesus has a holistic picture of life. And so he wants us to be changed internally so that that which is expressed externally can be part of who he is and who his nature is, as it is born in us through his Spirit. So as we are made new, that newness breathes out on other people. God's words and actions are synonymous. What he does and who he is akin to his nature. His words bring life. And that's what he wants for us. He wants our words to bring life. He wants our words to come from a renewed heart, from a transformed heart. And the only way that we can do that is to have our hearts rightly related to him. So I have a couple of questions for you. Where are you this morning in relation to Jesus? Where is your heart? James says that you need him. And like we said last night, there are probably some places that you have kept hidden from him, that you keep secret, that you shield, that you shut down. And what he wants you to do is open that place up, so that he can transform, so that he can reshape, so that he can rename. There may have been things that have been spoken over you that are not true. And the only way for transformation to take place is for those things to be opened up, for life and air to get in there. You know when you close down a room and it just gets all stuffy? It's like it's time to fling open the windows and get some fresh air in. So if you have a place in your heart that you have shut down, it's time to fling open those windows. That place needs to get some fresh air in. The power of the Spirit to transform those places that you've shut down. That transformation will then be pressed out of you into the world around you, which is why you need those places to be open. And like my friend said, it doesn't necessarily mean that's an easy place to go. It's hard. James says you need him. Whether it's for the first time in that place that's shut down, or whether you need him again. That place in your heart that you know has a root of bitterness. It's just down deep, and you've brought it to the Lord over and over and over again. You've brought it to other people, and it's still there. But we learned yesterday, we need wisdom in that place. And he doesn't mind when we come again and again and again. So come again with that place that seems to have hold of you. Come again. Bring that into the presence of Jesus, so that maybe he can give you one new nugget to help unroot that place inside of you. Don't give up. Jesus never gives up on you. Don't give up on yourself. Bring that to him again and again and again. He's attentive and he's listening. He doesn't find fault. We learned that yesterday from James. So come, whether it's for the first time or whether you need to come again. So again, I just want you to have a couple of minutes. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. You can pull out your notebook. Just ask God to search your heart. You need those things, these things, we need them to be exposed. And it's okay, maybe these things will come later. They don't have to come right now. Just begin asking the question, though. What is it that you need? Where is it that you need transformation? Where is it that you need to bust open the windows? Ask God to search your heart so that those things are exposed. Just ask him. Things that you know are there that press out destructive words, just write them down. Maybe it's just one or two things. Confess the things that you know that are in you, that press out of you destructive words through your tongue. Could be anger or bitterness or fear or pain from the past. Just confess those things on that paper or in your mind. Ask him to change and transform you and make you new. Maybe you just need to ask him to help you believe that he can do that. Ask him to make you new, to change your heart. Jesus' own words, "Behold, I am making all things new." I'm going to close and we'll pray, and then there'll be time for a cup of tea or coffee. But as you leave, what I want to exhort you is that we live with faith and trust. And so as you go from here, go trusting that Christ is in the work of transformation. And so you don't have to leave here with guilt or shame. Shame keeps us hidden. Shame keeps us locked away. And so if you feel shame, I would say one important thing is to practice vulnerability. You can maybe move towards somebody today and be like, this is what I asked the Lord to help transform in me. That will distinguish the power of shame. And it will give you the ability to maybe experience generosity or grace. And if somebody does share something with you, be mindful not to make a judgment or give an opinion about that. Pray with that person. Pray a trusting, loving prayer that God will be with your friend in that place. And guilt, I think oftentimes we don't like guilt because it makes us feel bad, but there's a distinction between guilt and shame. Guilt is actually one of the best things ever. Because guilt doesn't say that we are bad. It means that we've done something. And so guilt allows us to move towards either another person or towards God. And so in moving towards, we're able to be the recipients of forgiveness and so grace. And then we're free from guilt. When we live with guilt, guilt has the capacity to turn in on itself and become shame. But guilt is actually a gift because it brings reconciliation. Has the capacity to move us outside of ourselves and confess, I said that to you and I am so sorry. Will you forgive me? Lord, I did that. I said that to my spouse. Will you forgive me? And we know that Jesus always has a resounding, yes, you're forgiven. Go and sin no more. That was his constant, if you read through the New Testament, that's what he's saying constantly. Forgiven. So we don't have to live like those who are guilty or shamed. We can live as those who are free. So be good community to each other throughout the day. I mean, not necessarily now, but throughout the day. I'll pray and then we'll head out for our tea. Jesus, thank you for this picture of the tongue in James, that you are clear that our tongue has the capacity to be deeply destructive. And we know, as the recipients, many in this room have been the recipients of that kind of destruction. And yet we also know that we are, it's beyond us. This little tiny organ that is in our mouth is untamable. And so we come agreeing with James. And in agreeing with James, we hear your words, that from the heart the mouth speaks. And we know that it's you who has the power to change us, to transform us. And so help us to participate, to depend upon you, to lean into you, to act with wisdom. And that our hearts would be open to you in the places where we've closed them down. That we would willingly come to you wholeheartedly, because we know that we need your grace to transform us. We need the words of forgiveness over our places of guilt. We need to know that you cover our shame. And so I pray, Lord, for these ladies. I pray that there would be a sense of freedom that comes with bringing these things to you. A sense of hope and a sense of healing. And I pray that as a result of that, their lives would be lived out, expressed out of changed hearts. So we trust you, we depend upon you, and we need you. Pray these things in your name. Amen.